You're listening to Idaho Matters. I'm Gemma Gaudette. It's Friday. How do I know that? Well, I'm wearing slippers and leggings while hosting live from my house. Or at this point, for so many of us, it could really be any other day. And how I really know it's Friday, though, is it is time for our weekly reporter roundtable, when we do take a moment to get you up to date on the news that made headlines this week in our region. Joining us live, remotely, of course, Scott McIntosh with the Idaho Statesman, Margaret Carmel with the Idaho Press, Mike Sharp with KIVI6 on your side, and Madeline Beck with Boise State Public Radio News. Happy Friday, everybody.
Happy Friday.
Okay, just a warning. We're having some fights between children in my home. So if we hear a door slam and screaming, I just want to give everybody a warning as to what is going on in my home right now. So good times. Let's start with the very latest. And I do need to pivot a bit on a serious note here. So the state of Idaho, as of last night, has now surpassed Oregon with the number of COVID-19 cases. The reason why this is startling, to say the least, is that Oregon has twice the population of the Gem State, and Blaine County continues to be the epicenter for the virus here in our state. In fact, more cases than any other county in our state. So with that being said, Scott, I want to talk about the testing that's going on, because Idaho is behind. So why not, or even can we, increase testing capacity?
Yeah, and I want to make clear that, you know, Idaho is actually above the national average when it comes to rate of testing per million people. But, you know, as a nation, we are behind. So right now, Idaho is at about 4,200 tests per 1 million people, and the national average is about 3,200. And Washington State is leading the nation in tests per million people, 9,700. People. And the what's come out in our experiences with coronavirus is that testing early and testing widely has really proven to stem the tide. And we're looking at countries like Germany, Singapore, and South Korea. South Korea and the United States got their first coronavirus cases right around the same time, right around January 20th. And the South Korean government acted very quickly to start testing people. And they started working with private companies to start developing test kits. And they started building 100,000 kits per day. They opened 600 testing centers, and including 50 drive-through sites. And they have conducted more than 300,000 tests so far, according to the New York Times. And so that's a rate of around 5,800, 6,000 per 1 million population. So. And what they found was that doing that early testing, that widespread testing, helped stem the spread of the disease and enabled them to continue their economy much better. So they were isolating. So essentially, in the United States, we're treating everybody as if we all have coronavirus and we're all staying at home. What South Korea did was that they were able to isolate people by doing this testing and finding those folks early and isolating them, so they can continue on a little bit business as usual. And so we are catching up. And so I think Idaho, you know, like I said, we are actually a little bit above the national average and stepping up that testing, but we still could be doing more. And we've talked about this before in the show, that we have a lab in Garden City that has a machine that is ready to go, but the company that runs the servicing of that machine has prioritized, by working with the federal government, prioritize larger and more regional labs. And so we have these smaller labs, which could be processing up to 400 tests per day, sitting idle because they don't have the software or the reagents. And so it seems like if we could get some of these smaller labs up and running, we'd be able to increase our testing, because we're seeing people getting tested, but waiting 10 to 14 days or even longer than 14 days to get results back on their test results. So we are doing a little bit better, but we still have a long way to go.
Right. Well, and Scott, getting back to the point of what South Korea did, I mean, as we know, there are many people that are asymptomatic or have very mild symptoms. So you may not even qualify necessarily in the U.S. right now to be tested, if that's what's going on.
Right. And the idea is not that you would test every single person, but the more testing you do, the more cases you would catch and you catch those people and you isolate them before they can spread it to other people.
So speaking of testing, Margaret, a resident of the Boise Rescue Mission was tested recently, correct? And do we know the results of that and then what the rescue mission has done in regards to that?
Yes. So a resident of the Boise Rescue Mission Men's Shelter, River of Life, was tested, oh gosh, maybe 2 weeks ago. And last I heard, there had been no results there. And I have heard that they have tested several other people who live there. Now, the Boise Rescue Mission is what they're doing to try to stem the tide is once Governor Little announced a stay-at-home order, they closed the doors of the shelter. Normally, the way homeless shelters work is that you wake up at 7 in the morning and you get your breakfast and you gotta get out and go about your day, go to work, go somewhere else. And then you can return to the shelter around 4 or 5 o'clock to have dinner and then, you know, get your bed for the night. But what Boise Rescue Mission is doing is they are preventing anyone from leaving. They have closed the shelter. People are, you know, they can only leave for short periods of time to go on approved errands. And if you don't want to stay inside, you cannot come back. Because, you know, I spoke with the CEO of Boise Rescue Mission, Reverend Bill Roscoe, and he said, well, we don't want folks spreading the coronavirus around the community. But at the same time, a lot of people have left their shelter system. You know, it's unclear if that's because they are not complying with the rules, because they do not want to follow those rules, or they are finding other places to go. So it's a little different. The other shelter, Interfaith Sanctuary, is letting people leave for the day.
And Mike, let's talk about that because at KIVI, you just did a story recently about testing, though, that can happen at Interfaith Sanctuary now.
So it's, I'm sorry, I didn't hear what you said.
Oh, no, I'm asking, I'd like Mike to come into the conversation. And because Mike, at KIVI, didn't you guys just recently do a story in regards to Boise's Interfaith Sanctuary? And now, and they're running testing?
Right. So our reporter Madeline White, who covers a lot of the downtown Boise, the homelessness issues, low income populations in general, she did a story with Interfaith Sanctuary about the fact that Monday through Friday from 4:30 to 7, Interfaith Sanctuary is actually conducting testing, and what they've done is they've paired with the Family Medicine Residency of Idaho, or FMRI. It's an organization that specifically serves marginalized communities. So there are a lot of low-income populations, refugee, the migrant populations that are served by this organization. But specifically, they paired with them to conduct a test that they're saying actually gets results within 3 days. So what they do is they do the testing on site. They do it that day. You show up, you get the test, they send it off to the state lab, and they're saying they're getting results within 3 days.
Okay, so Mike, talk. I'm so incredibly curious about that they're getting results so quickly because, I mean, I have a girlfriend who was tested. She's in the medical field, and she had to self-isolate, you know, with her family, and it took 10 days, I believe, for her to get the test, and she was supposed to have it expedited because she was in the medical field. How were they able to get those tests back so quickly? Did Madeline, was she able to figure that out?
Yeah, well, that's the tough question. So apparently there are different priorities given to different tests, and because this is a pretty vulnerable population, mm-hmm. There is a little bit higher of a priority that's going. I mean, you're talking about a population that is a lot of times nomadic almost, right? They're moving around, they're going to different communities. They may be at one center one night and another center another night. So being able to track those and get quicker results for this population is super important. I imagine that there is, you know, if you're talking about St. Al's or St. Luke's, there may be a larger lag time just because they're a larger organization and they're conducting tests maybe on a larger scale. Whereas these folks, because they are able to move quicker and get the labs or get the tests to the lab quicker, it may just cut down on a couple days as well.
So do we know, Mike, because when Margaret was talking about Boise Rescue Mission and how they've shut, you know, they've shut their doors, or you have to stay in, she mentioned that Interfaith is not doing that. Is that still the case as of today? Do we know if they are, if even if you get tested, you're still allowed to leave?
Yeah, I couldn't say for sure whether or not they changed in the last day or so. This story that we reported was originally reported, I believe, on the 30th. But what I can say is, I mean, obviously they're watching, based on our reporting, they're watching symptoms. So they're handling people differently. You've mentioned, and Scott mentioned on it as well, that obviously you can have this and be asymptomatic, but at the same time, you can watch for those symptoms and as much as possible try to discourage certain populations from leaving if they're coughing, if they're showing these symptoms. So yeah, I mean, it's one of those it's a flowing and changing situation every day. So they could have changed this morning and mm-hmm. we may not know yet.
Go ahead, Margaret.
As of right now, the latest I've heard is the plan was everyone that comes in to Interfaith Sanctuary is getting screened, they're getting tested for symptoms, their temperature is taken every day. And if someone crops up with symptoms, they are shuttled over to the Boise Rescue Mission, which has more rooms and they are trying to designate specific rooms where folks can be alone by themselves or with other sick people to keep them separated from the general population. Mm-hmm. One thing to keep in mind is, you know, I've had some questions of why are reporters focusing so much on the very small subset of Boiseans who are homeless? And the reason is, when you live in a homeless shelter, there's no such thing as personal space. You know, everyone is sleeping in a bunk 2 feet away from each other. It's bunk beds. You're sleeping on the floor. You know, if you're sleeping on the floor, you're maybe 6 inches from somebody all night. Eating in a cafeteria, there is no way to isolate. And so mm-hmm. the shelter, but there is more room at the Boise Rescue Mission than there is at Interfaith Sanctuary. So they're working with them to try to figure out a plan of, okay, we're going to move people that have symptoms to where there is more space.
Well, and we should note, I mean, this is an incredibly vulnerable population. And as Mike said, they tend to be nomadic sometimes. And so the faster that we can get our homeless population tested, and Margaret, thank you for pointing out what they're doing and how they're collaborating. I think it's incredibly important that we get that information out so that people understand how that is working and why we are focusing on that part of our population. I do, though, speaking of that, how we're taking care of that, we don't all seem to be agreeing, though, on this governor-mandated statewide stay-at-home order. Scott, talk a little bit about what is going on in particular in North Idaho. And frankly, the Bonner County Sheriff sending a letter to the governor.
Yeah, Bonner County Sheriff Darrell Wheeler sent a letter to Governor Little basically saying that he's concerned about the constitutionality of the stay-home order. He wants to bring the legislature back to Boise to discuss points that are brought up in a letter that he says is circulating around the nation. And this is a letter from some guy by the name of Elfie in Naples, Florida. And Sheriff Wheeler has posted that letter on the government Facebook page on Facebook for the Bonner County Sheriff's Office. And the letter from Elfie from Naples, Florida talks about the World Health Organization providing inaccurate and misleading numbers. They're controlled by the globalists, and the globalists are controlling the media, which are disseminating this misinformation at the behest of the globalists who want to bring down the world economy, apparently in an effort to bring down President Donald Trump. So it's just, it's quite remarkable that the Bonner County Sheriff would be calling for, bring legislature back into session in an emergency meeting to discuss this letter from Elfie in Florida that really ventures into tinfoil hat wearing territory.
Well, and I believe I read in that article that even in some parts, I believe in Bonner County, they've allowed church services to continue. So they are not. I mean, the sheriff is not doing anything about people following the mandate.
Right. And you know, this also goes back to Tim Remington, who is a pastor in Coeur d'Alene, and he's also a state legislator. He was appointed by Brad Little earlier this year to fill a seat vacated by John Green, who was convicted of a federal felony, as if the story couldn't get stranger. But Tim Remington is a pastor at this church, and he held services, and he drew some criticism for holding Sunday services last Sunday. And in a follow-up interview, he compared the, the coronavirus to the seasonal flu, and it's not as bad as the seasonal flu, and continued to reiterate some of this this rhetoric about how the coronavirus is not that serious. There's some question as to whether it's pretty explicit in the governor's order that church gatherings are not allowed. However, there has been questions raised about whether that's an infringement of the First Amendment right to freedom of assembly, even though churches could still assemble online and virtually. This is not the government shutting it down completely, but they still feel that this is unconstitutional to keep people from assembling in a church service. So there are a lot of things going on with that, and I'm not sure that everyone is taking coronavirus as seriously as they should, and not fully understanding how this could spread and become a serious outbreak that could kill a lot of people.
Madeline, I want to talk a little bit about the food chain in regards to the coronavirus. You were on Idaho Matters earlier this week talking about why livestock auctions are continuing to go on. Can you talk a little bit more about that, but just the whole food chain supply? Because this could potentially even go back to why some people, you know, are hoarding, frankly.
Right. And the thing is, I want to caution all this to say right now what's in the food chain for the next couple months. I mean, it looks pretty healthy. Like, don't go out and buy all the fresh veggies and all the things right now. But there are concerns in a couple different key areas. And one is a lot of the workforce, especially those here on visas and things like that. One, we're going to kind of relook at what workers are going to be coming into the United States to help with that. And then two, a lot of the workers that are already here, they often work in fields where they can work 6 feet from someone else, but the living situations that many of them come back to are very cramped, usually just, you know, a small place for everyone to sleep. A lot of the time they'll be sharing the food and things like that, which makes it pretty difficult to keep everyone separate. And so if COVID does make its way into these specific groups, I mean, at least these groups of workers are concerned that they'll get sick and they don't want to get sick. So a lot of them are asking employers, or they're just not working at certain locations. And so that'll be a concern. And then there's also processing plants. What I talked about with the livestock is you have the meat processing plants. Those have been consolidated over the years, like a lot of different types of products where they have bigger facilities, more people, so they can really efficiently move those items through. But that also means you have a lot of people and in a smaller space. And so if someone gets it, you know, if it shuts down an entire plant, there could be a plant that serves an entire region kind of a whole state sort of thing. And so those are major concerns that people are having. There have been some cases at meatpacking plants so far. There haven't been word of actual shutdowns of those plants, but just certain groups of people that were working near them that have been sent home. But these are concerns that we're continuing to monitor. Like I said before, though, like right now, the healthy food supply chain that we have at the market, we've got some time, but this could be something that could affect us farther down the road. And I also want to note that there right now, the CDC has found that there's no evidence so far of COVID being able to be transferred on food or on packaging to people. So that's partially because of just how the virus grows and populates. And I know some people are still taking the precaution of, you know, washing their fruits and veggies when they get home, which I don't think would hurt, but I wanted to put that point out there.
I think it's incredibly important, Madeline, that we put that out there, especially from the CDC recommendations and what they have found in regards to that. You know, and then we have this whole issue of so many people out of work right now. In fact, the number of people who filed for unemployment in our state this past week was staggering. And on top of that, it's the beginning of the month. Rent is due. Margaret, this is affecting so many people. And you recently did an article about this.
Yes. So rent came due on April 1st, and a lot of renters are reliant on wages from businesses like restaurants or beauty salons or some of these other type of retail work that really has been hit hard by the coronavirus. I talked to, I put out a call on social media, said, hey, are you having trouble paying your rent? You know, talk to me. And I was messaging with over 20 people who told me, yes, I have no idea how I'm going to pay my rent April 1st. Now there's kind of this idea circulating online of, well, renters should be fine because they're going to get unemployment and then they're going to get the $1,200 check from the federal government and they should have the work they did in March to pay for April rent. And I really would like to just dispel some of that notion here, because unemployment claims, when you file, you still have to wait for your claim to be processed. And even if you do get unemployment, you're going to get less than you were making already. So for people that were on the line, already paycheck to paycheck, already barely scraping by, unemployment is not a savior. And those $1,200 checks could take weeks to get to most Americans, unless you have direct deposit information with the IRS already from your 2018 taxes. So this is kind of this big question mark of what's going to happen to these folks. And I know there are some benevolent landlords out there that are forgiving rent or saying they're not going to pursue evictions. But from what I talk to, those types of landlords are in the minority.
And then on top of that, I mean, so you have that type of stress. Then, you know, then we can get into the whole idea of how your mental health is being affected. But Mike, it's really pretty phenomenal what the Idaho Youth Ranch has started doing in regards to mental health.
Exactly. So the Idaho Youth Ranch is specifically reaching out to, you know, populations that may not be able to afford traditional counseling services. And to be fair, a lot of traditional counselors and clinics are moving to telehealth style clinics so that people can access those cares or that kind of care. But what they're doing at the Idaho Youth Ranch is actually launching their telemental health service in order to reach that population. One thing that I think is pretty cool about all this is it reaches a population that was already, you know, I feel like a year ago we were having the same conversation. We were talking about a lack of care that was available specifically to rural populations, where a psychiatrist or a counselor was not available in the community that people lived. Well, now they can access this. They can do it remotely, assuming they have access to the internet, which is an assumption. They are able to access this kind of care.
And, you know, I think in the midst of all of this, I mean, I think there is so much information to take in. It seems so dire. I think we can all, you know, get anxiety. We can all go into these rabbit holes of, you know, is life how we know it changing forever? But Scott, I think, you know, like Mr. Rogers always said, look for the helpers. And you wrote a pretty phenomenal piece about a medical student here in Idaho who is a helper.
Yeah. Yeah. Lei Yi is a first year medical student at Idaho College of Osteopathic Medicine. And he was a part of an effort with the Idaho Chinese organization to collect 11,800 medical gloves, 100 full body protection suits, 315 surgical masks, 125 N95 masks, another 150 industrial N95 masks. And, you know, a lot of folks covered it, and I think KIVI covered it as well. And I called Lei Yi. And it's funny because they tweeted out his name, Daniel Yi, and I called him up and he introduced himself as Lei Yi. And I said, can you explain that? And he said, well, you know, Daniel is my chosen name, my American name, before I moved to the United States when I was 14 years old. And I'm kind of realizing now that I should be embracing my Chinese heritage. He and his mother moved to the United States in 2007 when he was 14 years old. His mother was diagnosed with brain cancer at the time, and she was on Medicaid and had no other insurance. And they had trouble finding a doctor who would treat her with Medicaid. And so Lei Yi, he got on his Walmart bicycle at 14 years old and would ride his bike around from doctor's office to doctor's office. Any doctor who spoke Chinese, he would ask if they would help his mom and save her life.
Wow.
And he finally found this one doctor in his town in Southern California. And he agreed to help his mother and treated her. And Lei Yi noticed these two letters at the end of the doctor's name, D-O, Doctor of Osteopathy. And Lei Yi told me that was the moment that he realized his mission in life was to become a doctor of osteopathy and to help other people. And this effort to do the donations was just part of that effort to just put good out into the world and help other people. And just a wonderful addition to our community and just a wonderful young man and just really cool backstory to this story.
And these are the stories we need to hear about right now. So I appreciate you covering it and KIVI covering it and giving attention to someone who was doing such good. And I know we've spent the last two segments talking about the coronavirus and its impacts on Idaho. There was actually other news that happened this week. This little thing called an earthquake hit, because why not right now? I would love to hear from each of you on, I mean, we all know we were all home, but you know, where were you? What were you doing when it happened? So Scott, I'll start with you.
Yeah, I was at home at the dining room table, and you know, I experienced an earthquake in upstate New York growing up. And so as soon as it started happening, I knew right away that it was an earthquake. I was like, oh, we've got an earthquake, guys. And you know, it's so funny because even in Boise, even our natural disasters are perfect. You know, it was large enough that we could all feel it, and it was, you know, kind of exciting, but it was, you know, small enough and far enough away that it didn't really do any damage. No one was injured. No one was killed. It was just kind of fun, a fun natural disaster and a nice break from the coronavirus.
Okay, Madeline, what about you?
So yeah, no, I was. In my apartment, I was actually out loud speaking to my wall, practicing for, I was introducing I don't know, a story night event. I was going to help introduce it. And so I was trying to like practice my introduction. And then I heard things start to like kind of shake a little bit on my fridge. And because of the earthquake that had just happened in Utah, we'd all just been talking about the earthquake that happened there earlier in the day. So as soon as it started again, I was, yeah, just like, oh yeah, it's an earthquake, of course, because why not?
Of course, why not?
And,
why not? Margaret, what about you?
Yeah, so I did the wrong thing, and you can all laugh at me. So I had experienced earthquakes before, but it had been a long time, and I had never been in a second floor apartment for it. So I live on the second floor, and it was pretty scary. Things were shaking pretty bad, and I just, all brain function left. Like, my brain just wiped, and I panicked, and I went to grab my shoes, and I ran down the stairs, which is literally the worst thing you should ever do. And I live with someone from California, and she was very, very pleased to tell me how dumb I was after this. So I'm just gonna, just a lesson from me to you: don't run down the stairs during an earthquake. Get under the kitchen table and hold steady. So don't be like me.
don't be like you. Mike, what about you? Because you've got little ones at home too.
Yeah, that added a whole element to the experience. My wife and I were in the kitchen preparing our kids' dinner. We have a 5-year-old and a 18-month-old, and the 18-month-old was buckled into his high chair in the other room, and we were preparing the food, and I heard it first, which is still kind of weird to me that I was kind of trying to figure out, is there a rush of wind? Is there an airplane that's flying really low? And then my wife and I made eye contact and we said, the kids, you know, and we ran around the corner. We hid under a door frame, which I'm now learning from Nicole Foy at the Idaho Statesman is not the strategy to do, but we, you know, hurriedly unbuckled the toddler and held on to them and tried to stay as safe as possible and just kind of rode it out.
Okay, so I have to tell my story, and Child Protective Services, do not come after me. So my husband and I were out on a walk. You know, that's permitted right now. So the kids, of course, did not want to come with us, and there was so much whining going on. We're like, fine, stay home. Now, I have a 6th grader and a 2nd grader, so my 6th grader is old enough to be home when it's light out. So we're walking, we're just talking, and all of a sudden, we hear this man yelling, excuse me, excuse me. And I'm just like in a completely another world. And he finally goes, excuse me. And we turn and we look and he goes, did you feel that? And we were like, feel what? There was an earthquake. And we're like, what? And he goes, oh, you were walking. You didn't feel it. And he was like, there was an earthquake. Everything was shaking. And all I could think of was like, oh no, oh no. My second grader is going to be beside himself. Before I could even get my phone out of my pocket, our phone is ringing. It is our 6th grader calling with our little 8-year-old on the phone, so scared. And he was like, Benny says it was an earthquake. Benny says it was an earthquake. And we're like, well, it was. We'll be right home. We're right around the corner. It's okay. Just get under the table. Like, we'll be home. And so we get home, and I think we both still didn't really like, there's just no way it was an earthquake. We get home, the kids tell us about it. And then my 6th grader in pure forms, and I said, well, how did you know what to do? And he goes, it's one good thing that school we go to teaches us. So there you go. But I mean, this was near the Bora Peak earthquake that happened in 1983 near Challis. And what, about the same magnitude, correct?
Yeah, 6.5, and the Bora one was 6.9.
Okay. And then, but different types of earthquakes is what I've been reading about this.
Somebody else is going to have to weigh in on that one.
Well, I just saw Melissa Dablin got a response from a geophysicist who said that the way the plates were moving was different. So there was an actual change in elevation to some of the peaks with that earthquake in 1983. The way this was more side to side, from my understanding. And of course, this is coming from a very lay person when it comes to geophysics. So that's what I understand.
It's just fascinating to me, though, honestly, in the midst of everything that we are experiencing, that you know, on top of it, Mother Nature decided to throw in, you know, an earthquake just for fun. But the good thing is as I think, Scott, you mentioned, there was truly, I mean, no one was hurt. There were some damage to some buildings, at least in downtown Boise. In fact, St. John's Cathedral, Catholic Cathedral, they had to remove some stone crosses on top. So we've seen a little bit of structural damage. But I think other than that, I don't know of any other. I mean, I haven't been out, but does anyone else know of any other type of structural damage? I think we've gotten by very lucky, as you said, Scott.
Yeah, and if you think about that too, the cross on top of St. John's Cathedral, that didn't fall down. You know, if somebody had been walking underneath that and had fallen down. But yeah, no, we got very lucky.
We had some anecdotal evidence of some homes and things that had damage to you know, foundations, which is interesting. Mm-hmm. It's a whole separate element to the story of the fact that most Idahoans don't have earthquake insurance. So we're trying to follow that and see kind of if supposedly there was a rush in 1983. After that, a lot of the people who lived here then bought that insurance and they have it now. But a lot of the people who came here after then don't have it on their homes.
Well, now it's just like one more thing, right? I want to thank all of you for joining us today. Scott McIntosh with the Idaho Statesman, Margaret Carmel with Idaho Press, Mike Sharp with KIVI6 on your side, and Madeline Beck with Boise State Public Radio News. Still one of my most favorite things on a Friday is to be able to talk with all of you and get us updated. So thank you so much, guys. This is Idaho Matters.